Hey Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape episode. I'm Jonathan London, and each week I like to sit down with storytellers and talk to them about why they tell stories. Usually that's pop culture. It's movies, video games, comic books, TV. This episode you're about to listen to is a special episode. I recorded at the LA Comic Con 2 weekends ago. I was asked by my good friend Sheldon Price to host a few panels, and this one is The Return of Fantasy Storytelling. I loved this panel. I was fascinated by the idea that over the last 20 years, we've really had this rise in fantasy storytelling, whether it's Lord of the Rings or Dungeons and Dragons or Game of Thrones. I'm pretty sure we're all pretty aware that fantasy is back. So I put together this panel. The specialists and the experts on the panel were awesome. I think you're going to hear it. You're going to enjoy it. And don't worry, Geekscapists. I've got new one-on-one Geekscape conversations coming up. I've scheduled them with our good friend George. Thank you for scheduling those with me. So in November, we're going to be recording some awesome episodes for you. But sit back, listen to the Return of Fantasy Storytelling panel, and if you do like the show, go to your podcatcher that you're listening to this on right now. Leave us 5 stars. That really helps us. Write a review. That really helps our visibility, and that means more Geekscape. Hit that share button. Tell your friends all about the show, and thank you, thank you, thank you. Over and out. Hi, I'm Jonathan London from Geekscape. Geekscape's my podcast. I've been doing it for over 13 years, I think, and I think I know that. Over 13 years, I've been doing a podcast called Geekscape, and I like doing panels here at LA Comic Con. So thank you guys for sitting on ours. This is the return of fantasy. The idea behind this panel is that as somebody who's 40 years old, fantasy wasn't always as popular as it is now, whether it's tabletop RPGs or now we have things like Game of Thrones. And obviously they're going to start out with I think Amazon's doing a brand new Lord of the Rings series. So Tolkien has always been popular to people like me, but it hasn't always been popular on a scale of this size. And whether it's the technology or different things happening in culture, I wanted to put together a panel of experts so that I could just ask them, what is the deal with the stuff I used to get beat up for being super popular now? Does it seem fair? No, it doesn't seem that fair that I used to take hits for this stuff, for being into this stuff when I was a kid, and now everybody's into it. It's totally fine. But you know what? I choose to look at it as a huge celebration, and there are kids out there who were in the position I was in, and I'm glad that they're able to celebrate this stuff and be celebrated for being into this stuff. It's super positive. I'm excited to talk to you guys and have friends that I wish I would have had when I was 12 and get to know you guys. So this is the Return of Fantasy podcast, and I'm going to introduce my panelists. I'm not reading my Facebook or Twitter. I put my notes on my phone, okay? So bear with me, and I'll just go down the line. To my right is Mac Beauvais. She is an avid nerd. Especially, she's a big horror person. She is a TTRPG GM player. She's a tarot reader. And she's pretty much just a general weirdo, which is amazing. And her day job is producing product for Crypt TV. So if you guys enjoy Crypt TV, you have Mac to thank for a lot of that stuff, okay? To her right is a good friend of mine, Christoph Vischler. He runs Cantrip Candles, which is super interesting. He makes like D&D-themed candles that when you get together with your friends to play, you can light a little candle, and suddenly it smells like you're in a tavern or an elven wood. It's the coolest idea for candles, and if you're not convinced, talk to Christoph after the panel. I think maybe you're on the floor. You have a presence on the floor, Christoph?
Yeah, 1612.
Go down there and make a ruckus by everybody freaking out and being like, there's people just going and like huffing candles on the floor. Go ahead and go down there. Christoph's candles are amazing. And so obviously he's a big tabletop gamer and D&D fan because he's basing his business in it. To his right, we have Josephine McAdam. She's an actor in projects such as Tower, LA by Night, Scare Package, The Mortuary Collection, tons of other stuff, and she's been playing D&D since the age of 6. I was illiterate still at that age, so that's pretty amazing. And her dad was her DM. She and her brother used to play growing up, so that's a pretty awesome household. I wish you could still adopt me. That sounds great. And to her right is the awesome Alexander Ward. He's also an actor who specializes in playing monsters, creatures, other inhuman characters, so he knows a thing or two about some of the things that lurk in the dungeons. So I'm going to go ahead and open it up to you guys.
Thanks, Michael.
What a monster. I told you he's a monster. He's having people go and get him coffee. So right off the bat, I think we talked about it a little, and definitely I mentioned it in the intro. It seems to me that this has been an upswell of fantasy celebration for the last 20 years. I'm a huge Tolkien fan, like The Hobbit's most important book in my life. And for me, I always attribute the Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings movies being on the big screen successfully as being the beginning of that that turn. But obviously, being a little too old for the Harry Potter books at the time, a lot of people also attribute it to Harry Potter. Or maybe going back even further in the 90s, things like Xena and Hercules were on television, putting our modern putting myths on TV for people. So where would you attribute the beginnings of where we are now in this most recent rise of fantasy celebration? It could open to anybody.
Anyone at all.
Well, I think one of the most recent things really has been Game of Thrones. That's become one of, like, I mean, everybody has seen it. It's just one of those things that's out there for everybody to consume. But I think all of these upswells have been happening for a long time, and it's just really been building throughout the past many decades of time. And I think one of the things people are realizing that we always knew growing up and being into these things is it's about experience. And people are really into having experiences right now. There's a lot of things economically that are not great. So people, when they are spending their money, they're trying to spend it on experiences. And I feel like that's where we're seeing a lot of it. And we've always been doing that because we were spending it on games and things like that.
But I argue that these aren't escapes, because I was talking to somebody yesterday about Star Wars making $1 billion in 1977, and the fact that people, you know, we had an oil crisis and hostages in Iran at the time, and we were coming out of Nixon and Vietnam, but I don't see fantasy or science fiction or any of the pop culture as an escape. I see it as a prism or some form of catharsis. Right? Are we trying to experience a catharsis? Is this not escape, but release for us?
I think to a certain extent, fantasy and sci-fi can put problems that we deal with in everyday life into a more digestible format, into something that that's not as confusing as like our own current politics or anything like that. We can look at a situation that has the same themes that are going on in our lives right now and go, oh, I understand it in this distilled format, and allows us to, in an enjoyable way, kind of be like, okay, that gives us that catharsis. That thing was defeated, that the evil had been taken care of, all these things that we deal with in our lives in a more boiled down, distilled format can be dealt with and expressed. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gives us a release and relief in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah, I think it's also, I mean, I think it can be both. Some, I think, could still arguably be escapes for some people, and it's an individualized response, right? What it is for one person isn't what it's necessarily going to serve for someone else. I feel that, you know, growing up, it was an escape. It's just a world that you can go to where you can make up everything you want it to be, and like you can drive your own story, which I think you don't necessarily have, at least in the tabletop format. Talking about media, I mean, again, I think it's individual. I think there are some that people go to because it's that catharsis for something, an issue that's actually happening, or it can just be an escape for them.
Well, Mac, you work for a horror channel, and in the 90s, could a horror channel have existed? And what I'm getting to is the fact that today we have such a stratification in our media that things feel like they're targeted directly at us and our interests. So this appeal to the different niches allow people to say, oh, I'm finally being celebrated. I can come out of, I guess, hiding even. You know, I mean, remember what the comic book stores used to look like in the 90s? Yeah. They had the posters. They were covering the windows. Mm-hmm. You'd go in there. They almost looked like exclusive clubs. Right. Now this stuff is celebrated on the big screen. It seems only right that fantasy is then following in step. Matt, could something like Crypt TV or these different niche outlets have existed before things like technology or culture or the stratification of media existed? Is that so? Maybe the reason for some of this? I mean, this dude makes candles about D&D. Like, could that have existed 10 years ago even?
I think it could have existed. It probably would have been in a different format. Mm-hmm. And it would have been reaching out to people in a smaller way. I mean, the technology has really opened things up so that everybody is connected in a way that we weren't before. But these niche things, they've existed. They've been around for a very long time. It's just the matter that they are more accessible than they ever were. And so it's bringing these groups together. Like you were talking about, you know, being in school and being beat up and not feeling like you had a network. But if you had had what a lot of other people have now growing up with the technology and the ability to reach out to these other niche groups, which have become a bigger group and a bigger part of the mainstream because of it, I think that's really what we're looking at here. But it's not that the niches didn't exist to begin with.
I still had an ElfQuest shirt when I was a kid, and I have one again now, but there was a period where I didn't.
I also think it's a lot about exposure. As with everything, like you're not ever going to learn about something until you're exposed to it. You don't become comfortable with something until you're exposed to it. And when you're talking about Lord of the Rings and how that could have been a trigger for some to get into the world of fantasy, I think about how every year my dad would always be like, we're all going to the movie theater on Christmas, and all the Lord of the Rings movies came out around that Christmas time, December 18 or something like that. My birthday, guys, just so you know. And I remember being like, why does my dad want to see Lord of the Rings? But he would sit there and he'd fall asleep at some points, but that was his exposure to it. And so I think about like the media taking leaps to purchase into those niches because they're realizing, oh, people who like X-Men will spend millions of dollars on X-Men products. Like realizing there's a quantifiable profit to this, whether that's a good or bad thing, whether that's the right reason to grow fantasy, I don't care. It allows me to make a business. But I think exposure's huge. And going back to the whole Dungeons & Dragons candles thing, that only... My parents are still like, so what do you do? And I'm like, it's Dungeons & Dragons, but it's all about exposure. Like, you just have to tell them about it continually,
right.
And that's how you grow the world, essentially.
And I think you were going to say something, Alex, but I think just to finish or add to what Christoph is saying is the technology is we had in 2001 these amazing Lord of the Rings films. We had Ralph Bakshi when I was a kid, and we got one Hobbit movie and I think two Lord of the Rings movies. And it had to be animated if you were going to put that kind of fantasy on TV. We had Fire and Ice. We had the Ralph Bakshi movies. Those were our fantasy. Or you had the Ray Harryhausen stuff.
Right.
But some form of animation had to transport you there. And now the internet will expose you to these things, and you can actually believe them because of the technology.
And there's multi-billion-dollar budgets behind this.
Multi-billion-dollar budgets. Alex, what were you going to add earlier?
I was going to say, also, I think part of this is generational.
Generational.
The people who were into these things as kids are now the ones having kids and the adults in the world. And therefore, the interests have shifted. And originally, it was in the, you know, it was big in the 80s. It was as far as, you know, kids, you know, D&D, fantasy, video games, all these things started, and they were a small thing that everybody was like, what? That's a waste of time.
Yeah. Or you had to go to the arcade.
Whatever. You had to escape from what was considered appropriate life to go do these things.
Right.
And then now those kids are now the adults.
And they want to do that stuff all the
time. The time. And so now it's like, well, just have it out there. Uh-huh. Everybody wants to do this. And then also as a child growing up under parents who were into these things more... more prevalent in these adults than it was in the past. The kids are then possibly exposed to it more interested in it, and then with the addition of internet and things like that, it's just all out there, and they can find everything they need. And I think also part of the interest in fantasy is probably attributed a lot to things like World of Warcraft as a video game, going in and kids living in this world and playing, being kids starting in this fantasy world and have been playing it for 12 years, however long that game's been out.
Right.
But games like that have also contributed to this love of fantasy and this resurgence of it.
Yeah. I had Richard Garfield on Geekscape a few weeks ago, and he was talking about making Magic the Gathering and how it took him a long time to convince the publisher, Wizards of the Coast, to put out Magic the Gathering. And, I mean, he had the design, and he's a mathematician, so he had all the math worked out for years before finally in 92, 93, 94, he convinced them to publish the card deck. And then it was wildfire to the point where, as we were saying earlier, it saved TSR.
Yeah,
Is this a perfect storm sort of event that we're living in right now, where it's the internet, it's gaming conditioning people, it's social gaming conditioning people. It's the technology. It's a bit of political or real world fatigue. Mm-hmm. War on terror driving us into other things. What's that?
Just a bit.
Just a bit. The perfect storm?
I think possibly, but speaking with tabletop RPGs specifically, the rise in how popular those are within the last couple of years has been just absolutely mind blowing. I think it's partially due to the fact that people are so possibly getting to the point of being fatigued with so much visual media, video games, things like that, that they want a more personal experience. And so sitting down at a table with friends and all sitting there and looking at each other in the eye and playing a game with each other has become far more popular than it has been in the last 10 years, within the last 3 or 4 years.
People would rather tell their own story than someone else's story that's not done well, or taking a story that they love, aka Avatar, and turning it into something terrible. So people would rather hold what they love preciously and play it in their own
time. I'm sure if any of you have played tabletop RPGs, you know that the people you play with generally become some of your best friends. And you end up hanging out with them more than you hang out with anybody else. That's all you want to do. We talk about our game together all the fucking time. All the time.
Yep.
Like, we'll just be like, yeah, so we're doing... No, but I want to talk about this. What do you think this person's doing?
I also think it's relative. I wonder all the time, is it just because I'm surrounded by the circles of people that like the same things? Because I will go to work. I will go on set, and I am still greeted with the same puzzled looks of like, what? Dean, what are you doing?
Same.
I'm sorry. Like all the time. Mm-hmm. Even the people creating this media, which I think would surprise a lot of people that have no idea what they're feeding into and like this huge culture that it is. And, you know, I grew up with Lord of the Rings and all of that, and I didn't get people to play D&D with me until for my 18th birthday, I asked all of my friends to come and play D&D. That was like my birthday wish. Mm-hmm. And I got them to sit down, and we all played, and it was a lot of fun. But we still didn't. They didn't play after that. It was still like it took a few years after that. Yes, yeah. It took a few years after that until now they're totally down to play D&D. Everyone's into it. But I feel like, honestly, shows like Critical Role added so much, because I was able to then ask people like, well, have you heard of Critical Role? And they're like, oh yeah, no, isn't that, you know? And then I would go from there and like try to like, yeah, it's actually really fun, we could do that, and here, let me show you how.
Well, and speaking D&D specifically, I think it's also much more of an accessible game than it used to be, with the 5th edition rules as the way they are now, because the game used to be so much math related and so much like, I don't want to do any of this just to fight a dragon. and now it's much more freeform and much more able to be like, no, I just want to tell this story, and that's the most important
thing. So Josephine's friends who were like, how long is this going to take?
Yeah.
It's not a day.
Right.
It's now you could do a birthday dinner and you're done.
It's still a day.
I mean, I was, it was still
4 hours.
I mean, like, it wasn't a math crunchy game. Like, I was, like, by the time they played with me, it was probably, I think it was in the in-between phase of D&D Next.
Sure.
which maybe wasn't helpful for them. But, I think was still very accessible. But I think being able to show a video, right? Like, look at these people playing this game. Here's an example of them playing. Look how much
funny.
Fun they're
yeah.
having. Easier for me.
So, Mac, if you wanted to say something.
Oh, I was just going to say it's also interesting because you've got all these groups of friends that are getting together and playing games, but you also have a lot of these games are being streamed now. Mm-hmm. So it's making it, a lot of times those viewers feel like, oh, I'm not alone, almost feel like these are my friends because they're getting to see people that they can relate to via like Twitch and things like that.
Yeah.
And it's made it so accessible, and there's so many game systems out there as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we talk mostly about D&D, but
having, there's so many.
You know, Powered by the Apocalypse, and you know, just system upon system upon system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a little something for everybody now.
Right.
I also think it's you were talking about the perfect storm concept, and I think yes, it's technology and timing and all that, but it also maybe now is the time that all the fantasy that you had to fight really hard to get to exist in and all that, because it was a little bit more rare. Now there's enough of it that there's a deep pool to draw from. So if you want to get someone into Dungeons and Dragons, you can be like Legolas, and that actually means something to them because they saw that concept.
Right.
Or you can just draw from the Chronicles of Narnia is being made into a movie series. Like, that's a big deal, and before they were just these books that maybe your parents read to you. So I think there's a wide depth to be able to pull from now, and that kind of compounds into more and more and more fantasy.
So the question is this a trend? Is there a threat of exhaustion with so much of it? At what point do competing systems like Max said, start to cannibalize each other when one becomes dominant and these other smaller games maybe don't get the same attention or don't get the same exposure? Is there a threat that this will become oversaturated?
I don't know. I don't know if it'll ever get to that point, because everybody's going to have their own personal tastes, and everybody's going to want to play something slightly different. Maybe D&D's not your thing.
Are we outracing overpopulation?
As
long as we just make more people, we make more fans.
Yeah, exactly. With the amount of people we have on this planet, I'm sure there's enough games for everybody. But there's always going to be different games. You could be into Vampire, you could be into D&D, you could be into Shadowrun, you could be into, I don't know, Cult, or whatever you want to play. But I think there's no one who likes playing tabletop RPGs ever gets bored of tabletop RPGs. Yeah. I've never experienced that.
But what about the media? What about what about fantasy films? What about fantasy television? Is there a point where I loved Game of Thrones, but then I watched season 8 and I'm a little less excited for the spin-off series, right? Or they're making 3 new Game of Thrones series. We see a sequel do badly at the box office, it always affects that next movie. Mm-hmm. It erodes that brand. The spinoffs that are going to come out of Game of Thrones have been announced. Right. They're in production. Does season 7, season 8, does it affect those? At what point do these things start to recede?
I hope not, because I want to keep working.
Yeah. I think, not to be pessimistic, I do think it will. The trend will break, but it will still exist. Obviously,
but is it a trend?
I think kind of yes, at least specifically with tabletop RPGs. I mean, obviously they've been around; they're going to stay around. But I think right now we're in this. It was the D&D 5e book was on Amazon as a bestseller for I think 6 months in a row. It was like insane, and it was selling a ton. That's not going to probably happen again until maybe 6th edition. Who knows if that ever happens?
Right,
but I think the bubble has to pop at some point, but that doesn't mean that it will pop and there will be nothing left. I think it will be a pop and we'll kind of go.
We'll just plateau. We'll stay.
Yeah.
But tabletop gamers are like the most hardcore of the fantasy fans.
But I'm
talking about your aunts and uncles who were like, I watched that Game of Thrones. Pretty tight.
Yeah. That's exactly my answer.
Rode around a dragon.
That'll keep happening for a while.
Yeah, I think there is going to be some level of fatigue as far as fantasy things go in media, in movies, in television, and whatnot, just because there's so much of it right now, and people are, as the same thing happened with zombie films.
Mm-hmm.
There was so much zombie media for so long, and The Walking Dead's kind of the last bastion of, like, zombie! And that's going right now. So that's... has a possibility of happening with fantasy and things like that, but I don't think it'll ever go away. There are still zombie films, there are still things like that, and everybody is going to always love that stuff, but I think the media sensation that is these things will mellow out eventually.
It's just cyclical, I think. Yeah,
it's going to be interesting to see, though, because unlike zombies, where it's a very niche thing within horror, which is its own focus, there's so many options for fantasy and sci-fi and so many places for it to go that certain subsects, I think, of fantasy and sci-fi might get burnout and get fatigue, but there's always going to be the next one.
Not unlike horror.
There's always the next thing. Zombies are burned out right now, so we've moved to,
vampires,
other
cool
things. You know,
ago.
Or like vampires or, slashers. There's always another...
sub-genre.
Avenue you can go down within that
the
genre.
The zombie always seemed to duck and weave with societal turns.
Yes. And in the movies.
Yeah. Yeah, in the movies.
But
I think, honestly, before fantasy burns out, I think we're going to have superhero burnout before fantasy burns out.
Oh, it's already...
I think they have to start diversifying their product pretty
quickly. It's cool, but I'm done.
But from the outside looking in at fantasy, is fantasy diversified? I want to ask you guys, what was your first taste? I talked about my father giving me The Hobbit as my beginnings for getting into fantasy, and obviously that spinner rack at the grocery store, getting me into comic books and getting me into those elf quests and things like that. when you start getting tired of superheroes, you're like, oh, wait, I want to go into the indies, and you start discovering things like that. Yeah. What were your kind of, oh, this is a thing for me. This speaks to me. Mac, what was it for you?
Well, I guess it depends on your point of view as to whether or not you consider horror part of the fantasy
Absolutely.
Genre. Some people like to classify it as over there.
Tim Curry and Legend. Yeah, Tim Curry and Legend was still the devil and he was scary, but it was definitely a fantasy film.
But I grew up in a household that where my mother loved horror. Yeah. And so I grew up on the Universal Monsters. So that's really was my first love, my first real taste of that realm of fantasy, and especially like the Wolfman has been my favorite film since I've seen it when I was a kid. And so I've really kept that love, and it's just only grown and expanded and incorporated more things as I've gotten older, sort of like the Blob rolling through a theater eating people.
Mm-hmm. Has anyone seen The Tenth Kingdom?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I just realized, I think my sexuality is based on that. That heavily influenced my love of fantasy because it was this modern take with this dog and this witch and all that
what
stuff.
What is your sexuality?
Dog-seeming men. Like, any man that's kind of like a dog, I'm like, Tenth Kingdom.
Yeah, Wolfman's hot in that movie,
all right? That's fair.
So I think the Tenth Kingdom was my first taste of fantasy. I would always be sick, and that would be... I wouldn't always be sick. Whenever I was sick, I would put that on and just watch, like, the seven-hour Hallmark... What was that show?
I'm older than that.
Okay,
I don't
even
know
it.
I don't know
what the Tenth Kingdom was. What was it?
There ABC Family? Yeah.
It was serialized. It was broken down into chunks.
But it felt like a whole movie.
The
like
Tenth
a
seven Kingdom.
Seven-hour movie.
Yeah.
And you
if you're ever sick... Check out the time.
But the thing is, like, how important is it that your friends were into it? Were
I
your
didn't
friends
care. No.
Okay? Were your friends into the Tenth Kingdom? Were your friends into
no.
horror? Were
what?
Your friends, was
no,
there a place for this?
I literally 2 weeks ago. I'm not going to say what. We were hanging out, and I was like, you guys want to watch The Tenth Kingdom? You guys can fill in the blanks. And they were like, sure. And then by the end of it, like an hour in, they were like, this is the best thing ever. And I was like, yeah, you just aren't exposed to like the fantasy of it.
Thank you for telling me about Tenth Kingdom.
Yeah. Everyone go watch The Tenth Kingdom.
And I think it's actually streaming online right now, just FYI. I mean, I have the Blu-ray. I don't need to stream it.
Movie night.
7 hour movie night.
Well, like I said, I was very lucky. My dad played D&D all through high school and college, and so when I was 6 years old, he would run games for my brother and I at home. And it was never something that I did with my friends, so like I said, it was always just something I did at home. And we also moved a lot when I was growing up, so I was used to always having to reintroduce ideas to the people I was talking to.
Sure.
Right? I was constantly meeting new people and totally different culture and interests.
I find that prevalent in actors as well, that you moved around a lot and had to... I mean, there are a lot of actors who say that was the beginnings of their acting, were how much they moved around and had to reintroduce themselves to a new social network, you know, in person. And I'm sure that D&D probably helped too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wanted to be an actress since I could talk. Mm. And so I think for my dad, it was immediately... You know, he knew, oh, you want to be another person right now? Let us play D&D. Let you know, crawl around this dungeon. And, you know...
You're still crawling at the time.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Well, all the time. I'm crawling around all
always,
the time.
Always. I still remember my first death.
Whoa. How traumatic was that?
It was traumatic, and it was all my brother's fault.
Not so over gotten it. Over it, you're saying. So you've forgiven him.
No.
Clearly.
He was like a warrior cleric. He should have been in front. I was playing a Anyway, it was a displacer beast, and it was terrible, and I
Josephine,
was very upset.
I have this image of you as a child with a baby rattle that's also a D20. And if nobody is making those
wait,
for their kids...
I'm going to make that. Don't say that anymore. Yeah, that's
Christoph,
a good idea.
No, yeah.
A baby rattle that's also a D20.
Uh-huh. But yeah, I grew up... My parents are nerds. I would, you know, practice piano with a Jean-Luc Picard cutout on the side. You know, like, I always watching
French,
me.
By the way.
I was like, wow.
joining us on the panel, Jen, Awesome seeing you. Jen Kretschmer, she's a TV producer, writer, currently adapting Lights, Skin, and Earth. You guys are Lights fans. For TV, she's an actress, actor, and a DM player on a bunch of tabletop shows. So Google Jen Kretschmer and just see all the stuff, that all the content. And she's been playing for almost 20 years and DMing for about 15. So welcome, Jen. How are you?
I'm so sorry. Jen,
before I throw it to Alex there on the end, tell me, like, what was your first entry into fantasy? What was the thing that you were like, this is for me, this is my world, whether it's TV, film, or tabletop?
Yeah, my three most formative books as a kid were The Phantom Tollbooth, Owen Glyn Time, and Matilda. So it was fantasy right off the bat for me. It was love at first read, and I was an avid reader. I think I was probably 5 or 6 when I read those, maybe even younger. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that there could be these other worlds, these possibilities, always fascinated me. And Matilda was the first time I felt like I saw a character like me in a book. Because, you know, I have telekinetic powers and all that. But no, to see a smart character who didn't quite fit in, who loved to read, that was a joy for me, and that was an immediate connection. And Meg Murray was the same thing. It was this kind of awkward, bright female character, and that wasn't common. And so those immediately grabbed me. And to this day, I think those are influential on everything I do. And Phantom Tollbooth gave me a love of wordplay and the idea at the, I'm going to spoil Phantom Tollbooth, so if you haven't read it, cover your ears.
Oh, no. I literally haven't
read it.
But
the idea that a quest wasn't impossible until someone told you it was impossible, just immediately made me, you know, drop everything and go, that's an amazing idea. I love that. Going with it.
You ever heard of the Tenth Kingdom? we went off on the Tenth Kingdom
like
a little
dogs?
Earlier. You like dogs in the Tenth Kingdom? Alex, what would you say is your first hit? Into the microphone, please, sir. You're leaning back like you're DMing.
There are two events in my life that really solidified my love of fantasy, and one of them is very much like yours. When I was sick, I would have my mother rent me Legend all the time, and I watched Legend over and over and over. And but the first thing was when I was I loved Edward Scissorhands, which is very much a fantasy movie, in a very suburban type way. But I felt very much like him in the town that I grew up in because I've looked like this my entire life. And not joking, I have pictures of me as a baby in black leggings and a black turtleneck,
whoa,
and a leather jacket, and. But I lived in a very suburban... I lived in Sonoma, California, which is the wine country, which is very much a yuppie town. And I felt very much like that Edward Scissorhands walking down that street of colorful houses. So that movie was very important to me, and that was something that introduced me to the concept of fantasy. But really, the formative point as far as loving like fantasy, like dragons and knights and blah, 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 was being on vacation with my family when I was young in Hawaii. We had gone... some reason took me to Hawaii, and which is not the place I'm supposed to be. And I didn't want to go to the beach because the beach has the sun, which is not why I exist.
So much feels. And so much.
So I went to a bookstore that was on the beach. There was like this little shopping center near the beach in Maui, and they had a bookstore. And I bought the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual, and I sat in my hotel room and I read all of those books. I believe it was third edition when I bought them, and that was like, oh my god, there are all these things and I want to play this game, and then I didn't play until I was like 25.
Whoa!
Because nobody wanted to play. Yeah. Nobody would sit down and play the game. I played Vampire the Masquerade before I played Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah. Like, it was just like, it was, no one wanted to play that game, and then I finally found people that were like, you want to play D&D? And I was like, fucking yes, I wanted to play D&D for like 15 years.
Well, that leads to my next question, and I want to ask you guys, once you did have that first entry and you were like, this is for me, how hard was it to find like-minded people? Because I had two people down the street, and we played D&D, but that was it. And mm-hmm. And introducing other people to D&D just wasn't going to happen growing up in a football, like, high school,
right.
Massive football high school. And they just weren't going to be into D&D. I tried introducing them through TSR also published a Marvel Superheroes role-playing game.
Right.
There was a really great one that I remember called Toon, where you could just basically be in a Chuck Avery like cartoon.
Nice.
You could
awesome.
Be in a Looney Tunes cartoon, and you could make giant mallets and things like that and hit each other. But it just there wasn't enough people
around to get into it. So books, like Jen, like books were basically the refuge. And you just read through all the Dragonlance novels, you read through all the Wheel of Time novels, and then once you're done, you have nobody to talk to about that. How hard was it?
You just cry after you're done.
What's that?
So you just cry after you're done. You just cry.
You're like, oh, I just read this amazing thing, and nobody is here to talk to about it. That was the 80s, early 90s. What was it like for you all to get super excited about something, and then... Nada.
And then disappointed.
My fantasy outlet was through video games. So I had online friends that liked that liked fantasy and things like that. I played Majesty, the Fantasy Kingdom Sim, and all that stuff. Like, so I would go to school and be the cool swimmer jock, but then I'd go home and be the nerdy fantasy guy. But so I didn't really have. I didn't have a problem with that. Sorry, Jonathan.
No,
my life is perfect.
I think it's the result of being the oldest person on the panel. And obviously the internet opened the doors for this stuff, because if I wanted to play video games with my friends back in the BBS era, I was basically stuck playing Drug Wars. Like that was it. If anybody's old enough to remember that game, you had to dial up the BBS, log in, take your turn, sell high, buy low, and then log off. And that was you playing a game, and there were fantasy games like that. I think honestly, the Sierra games were my big entry to video games. Were the LucasArts games like Loom and those Monkey Island and those games? But that obviously the King's Quest games and the Heroes Quest games were in video games. That for me, and Dragon Warrior and The Legend of Zelda on the original NES were huge for me.
My I had two kind of outlets. I had one stealthy way of talking to my friends about D&D. Because there was a game, which I'm sure anybody who knows about D&D knows this game. Two games. There was the Baldur's Gate games, which a bunch of kids in my age group played, but had no idea it was in D&D.
Right.
They just thought it was like a fantasy like video game, and they played it, and they were like, this and this. I'm like, oh, yeah? Let's talk about this. This is how I can talk about D&D to people, because you know this game. Yeah, I was like, what armor? What is this? What's your armor class? And they're like, this. And I never told them that it was D&D. I just continued to talk to them about this video game. So that was really the only way I could get my D&D stuff out. And I'm like, I know all this stuff. And they're like, how do you have such a breadth of knowledge about D&D? They didn't use those terms. How do you know so much? And I was just like, well, you know, I played the game a lot. You know, I haven't read all of the books. But also, in my high school, there was a, hey, when you're in English class, if you want to get extra credit, you can read. We'll give you points for reading. So I read every D&D novel ever. And then I turned in all the pages, and they were like, you read like 14,000 pages. Oh, I guess I'm giving you credit for all these. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, I have a 250% in class now. I did none of the other homework and just read, and I passed the class with an A.
No, I definitely fell into the not having a ton of friends for a while that were into the fantasy stuff. I didn't start D&D until I was a senior in high school, and that was, I had friends who played, and they're the ones who brought me in. In terms of the fantasy books, a lot of it, I don't think until around sixth grade, when my entire grade, including the teachers, became obsessed with the Sword of Truth series, which, looking back, thoughts, but at the time, it blew my mind. I mean, I remember my mom letting me stay home to read Wizard's First Rule because she knew I wouldn't put it down until I was done, and that if I went to school, I was just going to keep reading. So she let me stay home to finish it so I would actually get some sleep after. But that was the first time that I felt like we all had this thing we could talk about that was fantasy and was cool.
And Harry Potter would be...
And then Harry Potter in high school, when Harry Potter started.
Kind of a big deal.
No one talks about Harry Potter.
Fun fact, I actually read a first edition British Harry Potter that was signed when I first read it because I was babysitting for a family that was...
Did you steal it?
Nobody had any idea at that point what it was going to be. And then it was eaten by the dog.
Oh. I was about to say, I was like, Jen, are you done with that novel? We have to lie in the birdcage.
3 weeks later, the dog ate the book.
How valuable is that dog right now?
So, well...
More valuable than Kristoff.
Not anymore. Yeah.
I don't want you guys to think I'm into dogs. Let me just nip that in the bud real quick.
Come back to dogs.
Men seeming like dogs. There's a difference.
It's a very specific outlet.
Specific.
He was a wolf, all right? Yeah, so it's like werewolf. There's like a different line there. We can get into it later. See me after the panel.
There's a whole subgroup. There's meetings.
Speaking of werewolf fans.
Yeah, so I got really lucky because I had a bunch of, like, the weird theater kids. So we all had different interests, but we all were interested in each other's interests, so we shared everything around. And, yeah, fantasy was our communicable disease, I guess. But we just really got along and really had our own... Yeah, I know, whoa. I say things and I think that of myself a lot. But it was one of those things where... It was a very safe, sort of tight community, but it was also a lot of, we had a lot of military kids at my school. So we had a lot of kids that traveled around a lot, were looking for, you know, something that they could latch onto and take with them. And fantasy is one of those things, like we discussed earlier in the panel. So, yeah, I mean, I got very lucky.
And Josephine, beyond your brother and your father, was there a pretty conducive environment to celebrating this stuff on a wider level with friends?
Not until I was older. Like I said, I people knew I was into it, but I was very much someone, I think because of moving a lot, that just I would just float into whatever circles, you know. I wasn't like only ever with the theater kids. I'd be with the theater kids, with the jocks, with the people in band. It didn't matter, because I was used to just adapting to wherever I had moved to. So I just wouldn't talk to them about those things. You know, I would just cater what I was into, yeah, right, like, in this conversation. I mean, I would bring it up every now and then, but people... I didn't get a response to it until, like, college, mm-hmm, is when I started seeing people more receptive to the idea of D&D.
One thing that I remember, and I want to talk about is... Again, I like to think of 20 years ago as these things started going on the big screen, and I know Jennifer and I talked in the car before this, and she was saying I think Buffy brought it to a lot of people early on, just like the fantasy that you're watching. You're watching Fantasy Weekly at this point, and obviously there was Hercules and Xena and things like that. But let's talk about the reception for people getting into this stuff. Comic books, again, like I said, used to have posters in the windows. The people were playing Warhammer in the back, and it was almost like a
Warhammer.
It's almost like a private club. At what point did the private club start breaking up? Because if you didn't have friends in your high school that were into this stuff, you did have to go to the comic book stores and the hobby shops to get into this and to network and find people to play with. But it was a pretty male, dominated thing for a long time. And honestly, guys, it wasn't until about 15-plus years ago that I looked up and said, wow, whatever that was, it totally is broken apart. Mm-hmm. And women are starting to get into the Comic-Con and starting to get into the gaming and starting to get into the tabletop and the fantasy.
Looking into this room right now, there's a pretty much even 50-50 split, which is awesome.
Which is rad.
What were the things that tore that wall down?
I'm challenging you on that a little bit, because there were women working at TSR. Dragonlance was written and created by women.
Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, of course. Mm-hmm. I read every novel.
So women have been driving fantasy and science fiction from the very beginning. It's just that it was not necessarily spoken about as openly. People wrote under pseudonyms. A lot of the time we didn't talk about it because it wasn't seen as something that was feminine or appropriate for us to be interested in or mm-hmm. doing as a hobby.
But Jen, what were those big things that broke those clubs apart?
Buffy was a huge one. Harry Potter was a huge one. You know, these are either female focused or female driven or female created series, and they, you know, I think women have been driving that, but it took a while for people to kind of take that, to divest that and go, these are really cool stories. You know, I think Buffy was a huge one in terms of breaking down barriers with Comic-Con. If you look at the numbers, starting the year that the Buffy cast came to Comic-Con, it more than tripled. And it continued to double, I think, every year after that until it reached sort of the size that it is now. So that was a huge shattering of those barriers and those doors.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's still... Those bears are still there.
Yeah.
No, we're good. Everything's good. We're done.
Yeah, we broke holes through them, but there are still the honeycomb wall up in front of us.
What would those bears be, Josephine? Like the bears to acceptance?
Oof. Wait, hold on.
I think.
Yes,
can we have another 30 minutes on the panel?
How to get rid of those, or what we're still encountering?
What are they, and what do you think are some of the things that, like, let's say...
I mean, I'm still worried about talking on voice chat and video games.
Yeah.
I mean, not worried. Like, I will still do it, but I still encounter...
That's toxic as hell.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I started in StarCraft 2, and I immediately turned off all of my voice chat so quickly.
I did the same thing in WoW.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think it depends how you were raised. I was saying I grew up watching Miyazaki films, and I would watch Princess Mononoke every single day when I was like 7. Yeah, every day. It was a lot.
It was excessive.
And all of his films have such powerful, women in them, and it's not really pointed out, right? It's not until you think about it after.
Think about it. There's so many leads.
And Nausicaa was my first Miyazaki film.
Nausicaa's great.
And I couldn't believe what I was watching.
Yeah. Mm. But for me, I was always like, no, I'm just going to say what I think, I deserve a space here. It doesn't mean I'm not going to have combative responses, and I still get them. But it has lessened a lot. Like, from me playing StarCraft to me playing Overwatch, I will say it has gotten a lot better. I'm not sure what necessarily caused that.
Well, if any of you have questions, please raise your hands, but I'd like to think that maybe there's people in the audience who would want those kind of approaches to meeting that kind of resistance. If there are people in the audience who've had that online, or if there's just any general questions for any of our panelists, I think we have a few minutes left, and this is the time to open
it
up questions.
We have, in fact, 5 minutes left.
For anybody.
That was my favorite, the like very on the point, like 12:45, 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, I love it. That was great.
We're good, guys? Where are we at?
We got 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Yeah. Are there any questions really from the audience for any of these talented panelists?
I'm very ready for your questions.
We got one over here on the right. Please repeat the question if it's directed to you. Well, I'll admit it. My first real, oh my God, like my first like moment as a kid with a burgeoning sexuality was a Frank Frazetta poster in a gaming store. Like, that's just like, I was like, oh my God, that's beautiful. But it was the sexualization of a female form. And that was prevalent for a long time. It's still prevalent in a lot of these fantasy things. Even if you give her a sword, she's still in a bikini. Like, how is, I mean, is that stuff starting to erode? Is that stuff starting to be?
I think it's starting to erode. Yeah. I mean, it's not gone, obviously.
Right.
But hopefully it's starting to, I mean, there's nothing wrong with somebody being sexy, but objectifying somebody and having this art be that is their only purpose is not good.
The example given to us by the audience member was with the outcry about Starfire's depiction in the comics recently. It was a couple of years ago.
Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah.
So no one wants to read a story where their analog is a prop.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You want to read a story where you're doing something, where you're a hero, where you have struggles and you're flawed and you're overcoming challenges and, you know, there's development and growth and you go through an arc. I mean, that's storytelling 101, but so often historically women in stories have been props. There's the sexy lamp test.
I was just about to mention the sexy lamp test.
Yeah. It's if your woman can be replaced by a sexy lamp with a post-it on it, you're a hack. That's the sexy lamp test.
Yeah.
And it's astonishing how many things fail the sexy lamp test.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I think that's the question. You can have sexy characters, absolutely, and sexual characters, but
they also need to do something.
They have to do something.
They have to own it for themselves, mm-hmm. and it's about the fantasy of being able to own that for yourself, and that's really where the difference is.
Right, which is very much becoming more prevalent, which is great, but it's not at the point where it's not a thing. You know, the other part of it is still very much a thing that is going away, but hasn't gone away, which is what people are working towards.
Well, I would like to call on female Loki at your question.
Oh,
did social media help or hurt the inclusiveness in fantasy
sci-fi? Social media
is
complicated.
It can't,
in an idealized way, in an idealized world, social media can be great and can really help these situations, but I think more often than not, social media causes harm than it does good.
I disagree, respectfully. I think it's incredible.
You don't have to do it respectively.
I don't like you.
No. There we go. That's what I was looking for.
I think, yes, social media can be completely toxic and damaging, but I have conversations with Jen on Twitter and people who I would never normally talk to just because I don't have access to their...
It's all about exposure.
Like, if you want to change minds, you have to expose them to stuff, and that takes time, and it's frustrating because you might have the correct answer and you just want this person to know that, but it takes time, and you just have to show it over and over again.
It took me time, and I learned through a lot of the people I've been in touch with in social media in terms of an intersectional approach to changing media and the industry. I needed to know where those gaps were, or at least the ones that I'm aware of, and start actively following people from communities that I'm not a part of, or I wasn't aware of, or I didn't, you know much about. I have to start changing my own mind actively and opening myself up to that. And social media has been amazing for that. And it's allowed me to, in my own creative work, start to open up to characters that I might not have thought about putting into those worlds, or you know, my instinct is, you know, my default has changed because of the communities I've talked to on social media, and I think that's been great. But yeah, it sucks when people are
also super gross.
People are more vocal for worse, but also for better. You know, both ways. Yeah, they will earlier today, I was talking, you know, there are comments and there are people jumping in to defend that, you know, and there's like conversations happening back and forth, and that wouldn't have just happened without, you know, such an open platform for people to be able to have that discourse.
And it's usually someone making a big mistake on social media that triggers some really helpful conversations.
Yes.
So watch what you tweet, people. Watch what you tweet.
But also own it if you make a mistake. Like, don't double down on it. If you've made a mistake and someone says, hey, you screwed up, think about it. Make an active apology where you're making those changes and own it and do better in the future. And that's the only way to do it.
Yeah, you're much more likely, if you own your mistake, to be like, hey, I messed up. I was wrong. I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
And thank you for teaching me.
Letting me know.
Yeah.
Then you just move on with your life. You don't have to cause this giant, like, no, I'm like, I stand by the huge mistake I just made. And you're like, why? Why are you on this hill?
Where's your political career without denial? You gotta, come on, man. You'll never be president, Alex.
I don't want to be president. The world would be way worse.
We have a question in the back, man. Yes. Never-ending stories of great first fantasy experience. Right, and what are the steps that in fantasy where we do work outside of the box, the traditional storytelling boxes, and taking things like the depiction of females from a prize, a victim, to the hero, and I think that extends beyond just straight depictions of characters. Mm-hmm. You know, at what point are we going to start getting these other characters? We already have in a lot of ways.
Yeah, so, more women writing fantasy.
Sure.
Having authors and in your everyday life, too. Being around women, and if they're not having conversations that are probably making you uncomfortable, they probably don't feel safe being open around you. I mean, and that's the truth with any marginalized community or minority community. So getting to know women as people, because I know it's shocking, but we are.
What?
Jen. I know. Sorry, my social media is about to explode. Jen said women are people. But starting to realize how multidimensional people can be and putting that into the characters and letting people be flawed. Mm-hmm. So a lot of what you're describing, they don't pass the sexy lamp test. It is, if they can convey the information with the post-it and they are a prop to be won or traded off or, you know, defended, there's no autonomy there and there's no agency. So giving that back.
And if a hero's not flawed, I don't like watching them anyway.
Yeah.
There's one note hero, no matter what they are. If they're not a flawed hero and they don't have to overcome something internalized, then I'm not interested.
What do you think, Matt?
It's really about having the diversity in storytelling. It's really, really important. But I also want to remind people that it's okay to have women that are villains or you know, in some of those traditional roles, so long as there's more breadth to them, because there should be men that are also in those roles. There should be, I mean, anybody should be in those various roles. We need all of that in storytelling. And so I think, you know, I love female villains. I think they're amazing, but I don't care about them if they're just one note. Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, there's not just that three-dimensional thing, but her purpose is to be that gate.
Right. So what about a female villain that's designed only to impede a male's path?
Well, I think that's interesting. Like, I think that as long as you have a diverse, like, not all portrayals of villains, of female villains, are in that one sense. As long as you have a range. I mean, because whatever, there might be.
We got to go, apparently.
A cell phone going up, yeah.
You know, that could exist. I don't know. They're, you know, villains are evil. Maybe that is her thought process. But as long as that is not what all female villains are portrayed to be,
and like, not all
the things are completely varied, and that's not what people think of first.
I think that if you switch that and you said the male villain is, his sole purpose is to block the male hero, that's bad villain writing. There should be a better reason for a villain to want to stop a hero than just to stop the
hero.
And
they're not villains.
Villains are heroes for themselves. Yeah. I think
the core of the question, though, is about women serving to further a man's story. Not having their own autonomy, not having their own stories, but existing only to further the story of a male character.
If it's a villainous, sexy lamppost, it's bad.
Yeah.
It needs to have...
I mean, they usually get better teeth and makeup, and it's good times. But no. But I think what we need is more female protagonists, or more what we call in script writing two-handers, which is two characters that are the leads. We need things like Frozen that give us interesting, complex relationships between women, but also supportive relationships between women, because often you'll get one of whatever category you're looking at, and showing the plethora of different types of people that exist. We should tell men's stories, too. I'm not saying that. Mm-hmm. But we've had, like, if you look at the number of stories about women are so few compared to the number of stories about men, and equalizing that a little bit is not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and don't celebrate the ones that are bad portrayals. Just stop talking about them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all word of mouth. I mean, they may be awesome in your mind, but there's more stuff to come, and it'll get better if you don't just hold up the dated and less than stellar portrayals on a pedestal.
Right, yet continuing to look at something that is problematic as being like, no, but it's great, doesn't help anybody. It's still problematic. It's still got things that we need to change those things. Yeah, it was okay for the time period that it was in or wherever it was put out, whatever, but it's not anymore.
Newer, cooler stuff can come along.
Yeah.
So in a way, the fantasy still has the same drawbacks and strengths as most genre storytelling. It's just it's a fantastic prism to what we're dealing with in our real worlds.
Right.
Okay, so I think we got to get Jen and everybody else to their next panel. So I want you guys to run through your social media handles, unless you have something to run to add, Josephine. I was going to give you guys shout outs and definitely go downstairs and huff Christoph's candles. I'm starting down to the end with Alex.
Hi, everybody. You can find me on Twitter at AlexWard777. That's my Twitter handle. And my you can just find me on Instagram under Alexander Ward. But Twitter's the best place to follow me because I never post anything on Instagram. I'm really bad at it. So Twitter's my social media place.
I am at JCVIM. It's impossible to remember. On all social media. And then tomorrow I'm doing a panel running a speed run of Tomb of Horrors, first edition. So with Luke Gygax DMing. So please come hang out and watch that insanity.
All of my social is at Cantrip Candles, CANTRIP Candles. And stop by booth 1612 downstairs to smell them.
You can find me wherever great social media is sold as at Strange Like That. I'm also doing a panel tomorrow at noon, and I don't remember where it is, but it's about the rise of the occult and mysticism in pop culture.
Cool.
I am Jen Kretschmer. I am at DreamWisp on most social media, DreamWisp, or if not that, DreamWisp Jen, if you're on Twitch. I'm on my way right now to go do a panel in 306AB about tabletop RPGs. So if you like to RPG, come on down, or if you want to learn to RPG, come on down and ask questions. It'll be fun.
I'm Jonathan London, as I said at the top of the show. at Jonathan Lennon on Twitter. You can search for Geekscape on any social media, and you'll find our little community. And, of course, you can subscribe to Geekscape on any of your podcatchers. We'll put this panel up on the feed as well. So if your friends couldn't make it, they can still hear it. All right? I want to thank LA Comic Con and all of you for being here and enjoying our panel.
Thanks, guys.
Thank
and
you.
Girls.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.